We're kind of late starting anyways, so this is Kai and Stefan. Give it up.
Okay, so much for the embarrassing part. Sorry. So this is Stefan, and he is doing IT security at Darmstadt University, and is basically concerned with a technological concept on privacy by design. So you don't have to mess around with all the lawyers, and so that would be the idea, but you ensure by technology that privacy and confidentiality is preserved.
Yeah, this is Kai. He's working in a computational biology group. His main topic of research is bioinformatics and large-scale simulation of systems. And that's the reason why we're giving this talk jointly.
Right. Okay, so what is TDR, telecommunications data retention? Well, the first look in, you know, the storage of world wisdom, Wikipedia, tells you that you're probably in the wrong lecture hall. So make sure that you are interested in that. So telecommunications data retention refers to the storage of call detail records, which is basically, you know, the telephone numbers, the duration of the call, the time when the call was made, and so on. And in the case of government data retention, it's basically what we are talking about, not about, you know, data mining for from companies, but really governmental data retention. The data that is stored is usually for telephone calls made and received, emails sent and received, and websites visited. So it's basically about communication in a very broad sense. And there were actually a lot of narratives why TDRs are necessary. And at least in Germany, the predominant reason, or well, stated reason to do that was this guy and his fellow terrorists. There are a lot of other speculations. So for example, going for people who play a funny game that actually inspired the talk's title. Or to preserve the business model of some industries from the last millennium and, you know, to ensure monopoly rents. Or, at least in Germany now, these days, we hear a lot about weird pictures that, you know, then are discussed on TV, that then, you know, if the bad people distributing those pictures. But whatever the speculations, we really, you know, take it at face value what people argued when they introduced TDRs, why that is absolutely necessary for our well-being. So, in all these discussions and in all these arguments, there are actually two directions completely mixed up. And that's the first thing we would like, you know, to separate. That is the thing, is something after an incident, so is it a post-analysis, or is it something, you know, preventive to extract some knowledge, some pre-crime idea, right, to identify potential people who might potentially, and so on, do something. And indeed, it is a case that the post-incident analysis actually works. So you can obviously dig into these call detailed records, and look what's going on. So actually, this is the network of the 9/11 terrorists that was reconstructed by the FBI without telecommunications data retention, actually. And the funny thing is, it's basically a static, or more or less a static picture that emerges. So you go into this graph or network and look who is communicating with whom or has communicated with whom. It is the after effect analysis, and there are very, very sophisticated data input or imports these days and adapters to various databases, might it be Twitter, Facebook, blah, 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 telecommunication, web search engines, whatever. But the funny part is that it's still highly, highly manual. So you do visual inspection and navigation. There's no really automatic thing to do. And most importantly, This can be done by quick freeze. So the police or the law enforcement agencies go to the carrier and say, hey, freeze the data. There was a terrorist attack, right? We would like to know that guy that blew himself up, who was he communicating with? And this static picture is completely, you know, achievable with quick freeze. And if you want to see what you can achieve, even as a private citizen, I recommend that talk by Chris on the DEF CON. And he actually shows in his talk, by this post-incident analysis, if you wish, that the static picture actually can give you, your money back if you fall for one of the Nigeria scams, because he identified, just by Twitter, Facebook, blah, 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 the people in Nigeria who took some money and called them. That was a surprise. So, social network analysis, again, after the fact, works. There is basically, that's reality. And this distinction between post-analysis and preemptive, analysis that might reveal some plot that might kill people, that is really important. And again, it's useful for the post-incident analysis, obviously. Then you have a lot of data and you can really, see who was conspiring with whom. However, and that is now a private opinion, it doesn't seem really proportionate because you can do that with quick freeze anyway. So why save 82 million people in Germany's communications patterns when you can achieve this line or this, this line of work without it just by the quick freeze method? Proactive, so identifying reliably people who might kill someone is, from our point of view, proportionate, and then probably it's also okay to save all the data. But the question remains, is it really useful? Because if it's useful and works, then that might be a reason to really be in favor of TDRs. If it's not really useful, well, then you have the problem. It would be nice, but it just doesn't work, so there's no reason to do it then. And that is, this question sign is basically what we are concerned about in this talk, to fill that gap. But that means we have to talk about security in a very rational way, and not without fear, basically. And I would like to recommend, although it's hard to see, that funny or nice YouTube video by Bruce Schneier on, basically the philosophy of security and what might be achievable and what might, what might be out of reach. And this very good book, The Science of Fear, which tells you or describes what mechanisms are actually addressed in a crowd like you, to inspire fear and then avoid this rational talk and probably science-based evaluation of security measures. Okay, so what are we actually, what is the setup that we see? Well, on the one hand, we have the innocent law-abiding citizen, which from now on I will call ILAC. So it's this nice, happy guy, right, earning his living in a big city or in a big community of people. And then there are the bad terrorists. Most of you might know this character from already shooting him in the head, right? Okay, so this is the network, and these guys form those networks, and these guys, form a huge network, and they somehow are immersed in that huge network and do their thing. Okay, the problem is we don't have any real data at that point, for obvious reasons, privacy concerns, the telecommunications people just don't reveal that, and police agencies probably don't have really an incentive, to have an evaluation at that point. So, but there are a lot of papers available on the statistics of those networks, so of the ILAC network, I have to say, and on the terror network on the other hand. So the terror network is really, there are several papers from the embassy bombings, from the 9/11 attacks, from the Madrid bombings, blah, blah, blah. And they are even, annotated by names of the people. So we know a lot of the topologies and so on, and we know statistics from the crowd, basically. And there is a slide missing. No, not. Sorry. Okay, so we know a lot of statistics, and for example, we know that the degree, which is the number of communications partners in the communication network, just decreases in a scale-free law, and we could repeat that. Then there is something like the neighbor degree correlation, which tells you if I have a degree K, right, what is the average degree of my communications partners? So this is something like, or you can really see kind of a hierarchy or a chain of command here. Because in real communications networks, a high degree for myself comes with a high degree of the average communication partner of mine. So that means there are a lot of people who have only, you know, two or three contacts, and these people also only have two, three, four contacts. But the highly connected people have a lot of, or know a lot of people who are also highly connected, and this property is called assortative neighboring. And then we know something about the communications patterns, that is, for example, the call durations, so how long does it take to transfer the information to make the call in relation to the degree, and you see there's basically a constant, and we can also model that with our setup. So we are in agreement with all the statistics that are known, and that means we know the topology by the statistics from the ILEX, and we know from several papers the statistics or the topology of the terrorists. At the same time, we know the communications patterns of the normal people by also these published statistics, but what we really don't know is if the communications patterns, so in the kind of how long does it take to call someone and so on, if this is different for someone plotting a terror attack. Okay, but that is the same situation law enforcement agencies would face, right? Because they don't know either if the terrorists are so completely different in their communications patterns. So what we do here is we just average over a lot of different scenarios, because that is what the law enforcement people would have to do anyway. So although we lack this knowledge, that's actually good, because we figured out that we then resemble the situation a police officer faces. Okay, just some technical background. We did some C++, a discrete event simulation on an agent-based pattern, so ILEX or terrorists, right? There's a very nice graph tool available for Python, and the statistical analysis was done with R, which is basically in bioinformatics the choice of, you know, analysis platform. Well, extreme programming, blah, blah, blah. These are the papers that were that published these topologies and communications behaviors. And then comes now the question, what are we actually measuring? And there is, you can make a distinction. There is 1-point and 2-point measures that actually tell you something about 1 point in the network, so one person, or 2-point, so two persons, but then it tells you something about one communication event. So it's always about, you know, either an edge or a node in the network. And there is, for example, the number of calls per day, the number of distinct communications partners per day, the clustering coefficient, which is a network measure that tells you how highly connected are my neighbors, right? So the clustering coefficient gives you an estimate of, say, something like the density or an impression of a hierarchy, of a potential hierarchy in the network. Then you can normalize that by the number of calls. If you make more calls, right, then probably you just, by chance, you end up with someone highly connected. You can normalize that by the information transfer, which we call IA, which is in telephones proportional to, you know, the number of minutes probably, or in web traffic, it's just the kilobytes or gigabytes in other applications. You can normalize then the transferred information by the link degree, because, you know, if you have a hierarchy, a chain of command, then you obviously transfer to the head of the plot something, you know, more information, because he has to gather that and coordinate things by the clustering coefficient, and so on and so on. And then there are 3-point measures, and these are now the interesting ones, because these involve three people and a consecutive chain, so a temporal order of communications events between the persons I, J, and K. And now we look at covariances. So is the degree of J somewhat correlated to the one of K, right? That tells you if there would be a hierarchy, say, whether I is reporting to some guy who is then reporting to the next guy. Then the degree distribution between sender and receiver over that whole chain. The clustering coefficient again, but now whether they are correlated. So it's not just, you know, the clustering coefficients of that guy, but whether this correlation coefficient, clustering coefficient, is correlated with this clustering coefficient, and so on. And then we also look on the information transfer, most of all, if, say, this information amount is larger than that one, which would indicate, you know, that there is additional information or might be additional information added to report to that guy. Probably a chain of command, probably not, I don't know, but you know, at the end, it might be an order, and then this is augmented by detailed instructions how to, you know, drive the car to some place and leave the bomb there, blah, 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 and so on. Okay, so we have the one-point measures, which measure quantities about the people. We have two-point measures, which measure quantities of single information transfer. And we have the three-point measure, so three people involved, that measure correlations of the people among each other in these small groups of three people, and which measures correlations or covariances between information transfer between these three people in a temporal order. Okay, that gives rise to distributions. So we get a lot of distributions of, you know, all these quantities in the simulation. And now we have to compare that, right, between something for the terrorist and something for the normal people. Because you can only expect to identify a terrorist if somehow his pattern of communication deviates from the normal people. And the standard approach to do that is the so-called Kullback-Leibler divergence, which is, from those of you who are, you know, either computer scientists or physicists or so, is kind of a relative entropy. And you have two distributions, P and Q, and then you compute this quantity, and that gives you in bit the difference between the distributions P and Q. Or better to say, that is the amount of information you have to spend to describe P with reference to Q. It has some good properties for our purposes. It's always bigger than zero, or it's equal to zero, so we know a lower bound, right? And it's only zero, and only if the two distributions are the same. So if there is really, you know, equality or correspondence in the distributions, that is not, the third property is not so important for our purposes here. Okay, this has to be, you don't have to read that, but this is the fundamental theorem that is the basis of our study, and that is the Chernoff-Stein lemma, which tells you roughly what is the false positive rate. And the false positive rate, it's given here, is basically the Kullback-Leibler divergence and a sign in front of it. Okay, so whenever the Kullback-Leibler divergence between two distributions is large, then, you know, you get a small false positive rate, which you would like to achieve with limited police resources, right? You cannot just send to every household that you falsely identified or predicted to be a terrorist one, you cannot send a police officer there. So you want to have this thing very, very big. What we now want to do is comparing the distributions for the terrorists and for the normal people, and we have a distribution of the indicator variable. Is this guy a terrorist? Which we know because we simulate everything, right? So we have complete control, but pretend to not know it at that point. And the distribution of all these measures that we acquire during the simulation. And the right thing to refer to the distribution is the independent distribution. That means there is no correlation or no connection between the distribution who is a terrorist and or a normal citizen and the distribution of whatever measure we are talking about. And that means, well, if this is large, right, then we have some deviation from the independence assumption, and that would be good, because then there is a signal that we can identify and get some terrorist, probably. Okay, independence means that a distribution which involves two variables for two different events is actually just the product of the single distributions, and if you plug that in into the Kullback-Leibler divergence formula, you end up with that guy, and that is actually called the mutual information, and that is a quantity that describes how many information I reveal to you, measured in bit, if I tell you, say, the value of x1. So if it's 2.5, right, then I've revealed to you 2.5 bit about the identity of x2 when I give you x1, or vice versa, actually. Okay. That is not the whole story. The problem with that is it depends highly on how you bin the continuous variables we are dealing with. Because you have to formulate that on a discrete alphabet, because you just don't have so much data. So if you discretize that, then we're talking entropy and have to take that into account. Here's a short example that I have to give you to understand what we are actually doing. So say you have a data set like that. So whenever x1 is A, x2 is also A, or B, B. So there's complete, perfect correlation If I tell you x1, you know immediately x2, right? You can work out the numerics and the probabilities by just counting how many appearances of A and B are there. And in the end, the mutual information here between x1 and x2 is 1 bit, right? If I tell you A, you know immediately x2. Because x2 can only have two values, right? The entropy is also 1 bit. Differently, the situation is if you have, say, 4 different symbols. Then you have actually a mutual information of 2 bit. Because if I tell you this is A, then you know W is on the other side. But yeah, well, there are 3 different other values. So what we have to do is to normalize the mutual information by the entropy of the column that we would like to predict. And the column we would like to predict is this guy a terrorist or a normal person? So what in the you know, subsequent slides, we will always show the normalized mutual information, and we have empirical evidence that this is the right measure to use. And that is the mutual information divided by the entropy, and then you see that in both cases, this normalized MI is just 1. And that indicates, okay, there is a connection between the two variables, and that is most important to have a unit-free quantity to judge which of the measures we would like to employ is actually the better one. Because there is an overall scale if you do not normalize that, and then you cannot compare which one is better, which of the situations. But if you normalize it, you can do that. Okay, and now it's your turn.
Okay, then let's go back one step. Let's recall again what we tried to achieve in this work, right? We did this simulation. The purpose was to see whether we realistically are able to distinguish, well, terrorists from non-terrorists in a real world telecommunication network. Yeah. So the first question that we have to ask is how can we do this, right? I mean, we have to compute some kind of quantities for those ILECs and for those Ts, and Kai has listed on this slide like 20 of those quantities. So the first question that we have to ask ourselves is, well, are those quantities actually realistic? Do they tell us anything? Yeah. Can we use them to distinguish normal communication behavior from some kind of terrorist communication behavior? And I have to admit that we made those measures up, right? So this is not something that we got from literature somewhere, but it were measures that seemed reasonable to us and that we started to just define and actually try. So the first thing that we needed to, the first question that we needed to answer is which of those 20 measures are actually meaningful? Yeah? So which of those measures are actually tell you something about the difference between ILECs and Ts? And to answer this, we made a first experiment. We simulated our communication behavior, so this huge network of both ILECs and Ts, for a virtual time of 3 years, and we computed all those 20 measures, yeah, individually for ILECs and for Ts, and we tried to compare them. Yeah, and what we did more precisely is we computed the mutual information between each of those measures and the flag that indicates whether the person that this measure belongs to is a terrorist or not. Yeah? And if you do this, then you realize that measures that yield to a high mutual information are the ones that are probably good to distinguish between ILECs and Ts, because, well, it tells you, you get some kind of information out of the measure on whether this specific person is an ILEC or a T. So let's dive into the results. How does this work here? Here? No. Here? Yeah, I'm not used to this, to be honest. Anyway, so what you see here is a graph. On the x-axis, you see all the measures that we have defined. On the y-axis, you see what's called the bean plot, yeah, of all the measures that we have observed, so of the normalized mutual information between the measure and this flag that indicates whether the person is a terrorist or not. So what is a bean plot? What you see nicely here is essentially the mean value of all the observations that we had and some kind of distribution, so an empirical probability distribution of this measure. And actually means that you see a bump somewhere, well, in a region where we observed many of those values. for each measure, you see actually two of those beam plots. So you see one to the left of this vertical line and one to the right of the vertical line. The left one shows the measures for a community of 150,000 ILEX, and the right one shows the same measure for a community of 600,000 ILEX. And what you see is that essentially those distributions, well, are very similar and don't really change much over the population size. And we try to order them according to relevance. So what you see is those measures at the far right, they have a rather high normalized mutual information, which means that those are the most important measures that you will be able to use to distinguish between ILEX and TIS. What you also see already here is that those distributions are very nasty, yeah, because they have like two peaks, and everyone who worked in statistics and did some kind of hypothesis testing in the past knows that working with those two peaked distributions can be rather tricky. So we know now that at least those four measures have some relevance. But this plot was computed by averaging over all possible values we had. So averaging over all community sizes, averaging over all terrorist networks we used, and averaging over all kind of parameters that we introduced. So the next reasonable step was to see whether this measure is somewhat stable. Yeah, stable over variations in our parameters. So we have already seen that this measure is more or less stable over the community size. But another interesting question to look at is it stable over the retention period? Yeah, so if you employ telecommunications data retention for like half a year or a year or 3 years, then of course you see different portions of information. And probably there's a difference. Yeah. For example, if you record only the communication of a few days, then you will probably miss some links in that graph. If you record the communication for a very, very long time, then you probably get all kind of noise which overlays with your data that you actually want to see. So what those two plots show essentially that at least the ranking of those measures does not really depend on the retention period. So the plot on the left shows you the measures for the 90 days retention period, and the plot on the right shows you essentially the same plot, but only for 182 days retention period. You can see that those distributions slightly change, but and of course there's a bit more noise here in this graph for the 182 days, but essentially the ranking of those measures is pretty stable. Another thing that we tried another kind of consistency check was the question on binning. So if you compute this normalized mutual information, what you get out is a real value. Yeah? And of course, if you want to plot those empirical distributions on real values, it's going to be a mess. Yeah? And even if you want to compute this Kullback-Leibler divergence, you want to discretize your distribution before doing this. So what we did is we binned all the values. So we divided the x-axis into like equally spaced regions and associated all the values in one region with the center of the bin. And of course, you can. It's now a design decision of how many bins you use. Yeah, you can use a very low number of bins, like 10, or you can use a very, very high number of bins. So we started with the number of bins set to 10. The reason behind this was that the number of bins shouldn't be too large. So there should be some kind of connection to the size of the terrorist network. So if you make the number of bins as large as the terrorist networks, then probably you won't observe many terrorist activities in each individual bin. Therefore, it makes sense to make a smaller bin size. And what we try to see here is whether there is a huge difference on those measures when we look at different binning sizes. So the x-axis again shows the binning sizes that we use, 10, 25, 50, 100. And the y-axis shows essentially an error bar over this normalized mutual information. And what you can see is that there's almost no dependence on binning. Yeah? So all the graphs are essentially stable. Ah, shit. Yeah, this is the modern time, you know? I mean, all kind of stuff happen in the background that you don't want to see. Good. Another consistency check that we made is, do our measures really depend on the community size? Yeah. So what you see here is a plot that shows on the x-axis the size of the ILAC network that we used to embed our T network, that ranged from a very, very small network of 50,000 people to a network of 1 million people. What you can see here is that essentially, after some kind of phase where some random things happen, those values tend to be pretty stable as well. Yeah? So again, this shows us that those measures that we have selected are more or less stable over all kind of parameters that you can actually think of. So I'll only show you two of those graphs. We have lots of more, but I think this serves the purpose here. So having identified four relevant measures, the next experiment that we made is to see what's the influence of the retention period of this measure on this measure. So does it make sense to store telecommunications data for a very, very long time, or is it more preferable to store it for a short period of time? Because there are two like contradicting forces in action. Right? If you store data for a very limited period of time, then of course you won't see everything. Yeah, so you won't see probably you won't even see every terrorist communicating at once. Yeah, while if you store data for a very, very long period of time, then you get all kind of noise introduced, all kind of stochastic effects that somehow hide the activities of the T's, and the law enforcement people are actually faced to. Yeah, solve some kind of needle in the haystack problem. Right? They have this huge mess of data, and they have to pick out the right parts, which tends to get more difficult the more data you have, of course. So this experiment tried to answer this question, whether it's good to store much data or whether you should restrict the size of data that you actually store. So we actually did two approaches here. We again computed this mutual information between ILACs and T's, so all the measures, and the flag that indicates whether this specific person is an ILAC or T. And we also had an alternative measure that directly used this Kullback-Leibler divergence. I'm going to show both of you, both of them in a minute. So again, you have a very similar plot, one plot for every measure. You see on the x-axis now the retention period. We arbitrarily chose a few values to do our simulation. So the values range between like a very low ones, 7 and a year. And what you can see is that there are measures where actually the mutual information goes down. Yeah, the more data you store, which is somewhat expected. Because again, you introduce much, much more noise into the system, and it gets much more complex to actually distinguish ILACs and T's. And then there are also other measures, like this one, where you more or less see some kind of saturation effect. Yeah. So if you let's go to this one, for example. Yeah. Here you see a very prominent saturation effect, namely it doesn't really make sense to store more data than 90 days, because the statistics doesn't get better. Yeah, it also doesn't get worse, but it also doesn't get better. What you also see here in those plots is that there is a dependence on this F factor. This F factor, if you recall it, was the difference that we introduced in the simulation between ILACs and T. So F essentially tells you how much more or how much less the terrorists communicate than an average person. So if F is 1.0, then actually there is no difference in communication. If F is smaller, then they communicate less. If F is bigger, they communicate more. And you see that also those values actually depend on this F parameter. But again, you see the same behavior. Yeah. So there are more graphs, but I think I'll spare this. These are just the two more graphs of all the important measures that we chose. So what we also did is we tried an alternative approach to rank the important measures. So if you recall what I said like 50 minutes ago, in the first experiment, we computed the measure and took the normalized mutual information between those measures and this kind of flag that indicates whether a person is a T or not. What I want to show here is a different experiment that aims actually at showing the same thing, namely, it aims at identifying those measures that are actually important. Yeah? So what we did in the second experiment, again, we simulated our network for 3 years. We computed all those measures for ILX and T's, and now we computed, for each measure, we computed the Kullback-Leibler divergence between the measures of the ILX and the T's. Because we, as a simulator, we know this person is a terrorist, this person is not, and we can compute like their distributions and directly compare their distributions by using this Kullback-Leibler divergence that Kai explained you some slides before. And the bottom line is that this experiment actually yields similar conclusions. Yeah? So if you look at the plot, again, on the x-axis, you see the measures. On the y-axis, you now see the logarithm of the Kullback-Leibler divergence. And what you would expect is that a measure that's actually good will have a pretty high Kullback-Leibler divergence, whereas a measure that is bad has a very, very low Kullback-Leibler divergence. Yeah? So all the points that are somewhat in this lower part of this figure, they correspond to measures that are actually not very good, yeah, because there's almost no difference between terrorists and ILX. Whereas all those measures upwards, they show a pretty big difference between ILX and T's. So they are probably better to distinguish those two categories. And as Kai explained to you, there's a deep mathematical, theorem that tells you a connection between this Kullback-Leibler divergence and the best statistical test that you can do to distinguish ILX and T's. And the bottom line is, if this Kullback-Leibler divergence is very, very low, then you will have a very, very hard time of actually distinguishing those two distributions. Whereas if you have a high Kullback-Leibler divergence, it's much easier to actually separate ILX and T's. So this again shows that there are measures that are important. And what you can also see here, this gray part of the graph, this actually shows you all the measures that we have identified as important with the other method. So these are the four measures, or these are the measures that I've shown you on some slides before, and you see that we get some similar results. Yeah? So we miss some measure sometimes here, but in general, measures that are good in the mutual information sense are also pretty good in this chiral sense. Again, you can, of course, evaluate the influence of the retention period, and again, you see very, very similar results. So what you see here is the same plot, or a very similar plot to what you've seen some slides before. So on the x-axis, we show the retention period in days, and on the y-axis, now you see the Kullback-Leibler divergence, and again, you can see there's some kind of saturation effect after 90 days, so it doesn't really make sense to store more data than this. In your statistical capabilities of distinguishing ILX and T's, you won't get better. So let me talk about one last thing that we just started to work on a few weeks ago, namely the question that we posed ourselves is now if our T network knows that we're actually doing this analysis, yeah, are there strategies that they can exploit to actually, well, make this analysis useless? So can we come up with active strategies that will allow T's to somehow invalidate all our results, invalidate all our tests, whether it's possible to actually disguise as some kind of innocent person. And actually, we started with one simple strategy, and you can, of course, think of many, many others. One was to employ a second independently acting cell. Yeah, so we have this huge network of ILACs. We add our real terror network, which is this first copy of this 9/11 network, and then we added a second network, an identical copy, but that's not connected, yeah, to each other. Yeah. We again made our simulations, and we tried to look what happens to the measure. So do the measures decrease or increase? And it's very interesting to see that you get very different results. So what we did is we computed actually the correlation of MIs, yeah, between the case where we only had one terror network and the case where we had two of those terror networks that were independent and did not communicate. And what I show here is the correlation coefficient again for each measure. And what you would expect if the measures are good or if the measures can actually detect Ts and duplicated T cells, that at least in the important measures you should have high correlations for both cases. And as you can see from the graph, this didn't happen. Yeah? So for the important measures, again listed here with this gray column, you see that the correlation, yeah, between the case of one T cell and two T cells, so the measures of those two cases, are actually pretty low. Yeah? You see only in one specific measure, which is kappa over IA, that has a high correlation. All other measures, show almost no correlation. Yeah? So this means that this active strategy is actually pretty effective to evade detection, at least using those measures that we have looked at so far. So I think this should yield us to our conclusion. So what we try to do is we try to implement an independent evaluation platform, a platform that actually allows you to ask the question, well, does telecommunication data retention make sense for proactive tasks? So is it useful in actually identifying bad people before actual events happen? Yeah? And what we've seen that is that there are some measures that you can actually use for this task. Yeah, there are some important ones, there are some unimportant ones, and you can try to analyze this using information theory. And what we've also shown you with those graphs is that the important measures do not depend on the particularities of the actual scenario. So there are measures that are actually stable over the population size, that are stable over the communication behavior of Ts, and that are stable over the data retention period. Yeah? And also, and I think interesting observation was that longer retention periods do not always mean better data. Yeah? As you saw from this from those curves, sometimes it can be useful to actually restrict the period that you look at, because the more data you get, the more noise you get, and this is what you can really clearly see from those graphs. And we've also seen that there may be active strategies, yeah, that Ts may employ to actually counter their identification. And we were actually very, very surprised that this very simple strategy of taking a second independent cell and an identical copy that's not connected does the job pretty well, at least what we've seen in our graphs. So this brings me to the last and final slide. So we try to answer this the case whether, well, here in this upper lower right corner we should put there was this question mark on the slide that Kai presented. So the question was, is actually telecommunication data retention useful in a proactive fashion? So we've seen that in a post-incident analysis, it can be useful, right? I mean, if you know that something bad happens, you can actually look at who was it, what happened. But for a proactive strategy, it seems that telecommunication data retention is very, very difficult to achieve, because you actually have to solve some kind of needle in the haystack problem. You get tons and tons of data, and you have to have some kind of statistical methods to actually pick out the right data. And this seems to be very, very hard. Yeah? And therefore, at the moment, yeah, well, there's certainly further research necessary at the moment. It's we're inclined to say that it's probably not useful unless someone develops better measures or better analysis techniques. So thanks. This was our talk, and I would yeah, if you have any questions, then I'm happy to answer this.
Hello. Yeah. Could you maybe elaborate on the agent-based model you used and assumptions about the behavior of the agents you used in the simulation?
Sorry, could you rephrase?
You used an agent-based model, right?
Right.
Could you maybe give a short sketch about how these agents were modeled?
Well, so is it on? Okay. So I mean, these are just nodes in that network, and there is a queue, so to speak, of communications events and when which guy will communicate with whom. And that is just, you know, worked through and stored on the hard disk for later analysis purposes. So the simulation, I mean, what you have to do is I have to, you know, think about when will I communicate next, right? That is, there's an underlying distribution to draw that event from, and then to whom to talk. But to whom to talk is given, you know, by the network, which we know because we do so. So I mean, we play like God, right? We model the reality. So we know to whom these guys, that particular guy, actually will talk. The only thing we have to draw is then, you know, the information amount. But you can do that from all the published data to get the statistics, which you have to obey in the simulation. So the simulation itself is very, very simple. The thing is, you have the real work is constructing a network that obeys all the statistics, and that was actually the most computational time here, when we're talking months, not days, right? But then the actual simulation, you just go through that, you throw a dice, right, and say, oh yeah, now in 5 minutes, I will do something. And then you just store that event on the hard disk.
We had a couple of questions in IRC. Hello. Yeah. First, a short one. Will you publish slides or a paper about this topic?
So there is going to be a technical report that will contain all the details. It's not ready yet, but it will be ready, hopefully, in February. So. And it will be available from our homepages.
So I mean, this is basically, or that was basically the outline of what we did. We have much more graphs, but I guess it was also already somewhat boring. But you know, you have to really dig into that, whether your simulation makes sense. That's the reason why we checked for all these consistency things, why we had this alternative approach, which actually is something that police could not do if they do not know who is a terrorist. So our alternative approach will be published in the paper in more detail, but it's just to validate that we are doing the right thing. But that's so much, we couldn't present that here.
And the second question, in your simulations, what distinguishes an ILEG from a terrorist?
Sorry?
Well, in our simulation, essentially, we decide, right? I mean, we set up a huge network of ILEGs, up to 1 million people, and we try to model this network in a way that it conforms to all what we know from literature about real telecommunication networks. Yeah? And then we, as a simulator, we put in some of the T's. Yeah? So we, as simulators, we know who is an ILEC and who is a T. Of course, in real world, you won't know this. Yeah? Right. But for our analysis, we can tell.
So, and what we have to add is actually that the connection of, I mean, there are connections between the terrorists and the ILECs, because, you know, a terrorist might call a pizza delivery service, right? So to model that, we assume that the terrorists communicate with outsiders like normal people would do, right? They have sometimes a normal life. Even terrorists have, you know, to call the dentist or something.
Because if this wouldn't be the case, then you could easily see some kind of clusters in the graph, yeah? You would see some disconnected parts of the graph that would immediately be visible as our T's. Therefore, you have to have communication events as well between ILECs and T's.
Which means that we have chosen the simulator, the setup, to be the worst for the terrorist, right? otherwise, if we would have chosen that the communication between terrorists and ILECs is quite different, right, then it would be so easy to identify them because they are, you know, the outsiders or so. So this is always, so the setup is always chosen in the way that it's, you know, the easiest for the police and the worst for the terrorists, basically.
I have a short comment. Maybe terrorist is very negative. I think your methods might also be applied to any kind of social, political, or dissident or activist group. So, I mean, yeah, it could be that countermeasures are very useful and in more oppressive regimes, especially. So, yeah, terrorist is very negative.
I agree, but of course, it was the motivating scenario. I mean, but this, of course, you're right.
The rationale to introduce that in Europe was officially terrorists. And you know that quote, right? Someone's freedom fighter is someone else's terrorist. So, yeah.
One of the questions is the T-cell data that you have for 9/11, is it real? Is it like really this single rooted tree with no interconnections between branches?
So to be honest, I was not part of that plot. So. I wouldn't know, but that is the official 9/11 report,
and that it was, looks kind of strange. It looks like a single chain of command, like military.
Well, I mean, you see, the thing is, if you do scientific evaluations and studies, you have to rely on published literature. That's the way, because that's the best information we had. But we had also the additional information from the Madrid thing, so which would be a different police. Mm-hmm. So you might probably be more satisfied. Mm-hmm. Because they might not be part of that conspiracy, but of a different conspiracy.
And there's actually much published data about this out there. So if you go to Google Scholar, then you will find probably 15 papers that somehow try to map the structure of several terrorist cells. And so we took one of those of the literature, which is the most reasonable thing to do, I think.
Okay, another question is the one of the most important things is to separate the important metrics from the unimportant ones, right? And you use two methods to verify that the metrics you selected are really important. Yes. And in the slide, could you go back to the slide with the vertical gray graphs for the second method? You have kind of... No.
This was the first method, but...
The second
one. Okay, second method, okay.
This one. For me, it seems like you have 4 hits and 3 misses. How is that a good result?
Sorry.
You have 4 hits... Sure. 4 metrics were approved as good, as important, and 3 weren't.
And there is one metric that is good in this scenario, but not good in the others. Well, this is, of course,
But again, this alternative approach of validating that is something that the law enforcement could not do, because to do this, you have to know the identity of every person. Which you can only do in a post-analysis thing. That is why some of the graphs also, for example, for the retention period, they are somewhat different, but the message is the same. 90 days would most likely be sufficient anyway. And the thing is, it gives you the same impression, but it tells you if you know something after the fact, or if you look into that after the fact, this measure isn't as relevant as you would assume from the first one, but that doesn't mean that you cannot employ it, right? You just have too much noise, so you probably put someone to Guantanamo who wasn't, you know.
So, as far as I understood, you gathered some data from other papers about the terrorist behavior. Can you tell us a little bit more on their exact behavior, like how are they communicating in difference to other people, and what were your assumptions?
The problem with this is that, unfortunately, there is at least we didn't find any, there's no published literature on the communication behavior of terrorists. So we know very well how the topology looks like. So we know who is communicating with whom, but we don't know much about the temporal behavior. Yeah.
But isn't the temporal behavior what you analyzed?
It's a mixture. So if you look at those measures, some of those measures are topological, some of them are temporal, and some of them are a mixture.
So what? Yeah? I mean, the thing is, this is what exactly the message of that slide. What probably I didn't describe it correctly. We do not know that field. So what we did is we introduced an adjustable parameter for the simulation, not for the analysis, but for the simulation, to account for that we do not know that, and then we have simulated that for various values. Because police didn't know that either, right? So they would not know whether the communications, so the temporal, you know, how often, how frequent, how long, blah, 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 that is included in that factor. And then we averaged over all the factors, or in some of the slides, it was actually, you know, put into different lines just to account for that. But the message is always the same. So whenever they communicate like normal people, it's the worst, obviously, because then the signal noise ratio is just bad. But even if they are very, very different in their temporal behavior, modeled by that factor, then still the same message holds. I mean, the quantities change, but their ordering and, you know, the ranking stays the same. So, and that was the only thing we didn't know. And that is the reason why we have chosen, as a police officer would need to do, that we do not know it. So we have just to assume, or hope, better to say, that the construction of our measures is not sensitive on that choice. And that what we also can show by some of the graphs where, it wasn't it, yeah. So you see here, right? These are the three graphs for three different F values. And it's indistinguishable, right? So it doesn't really matter, so to speak, how they differ from normal people, in that sense, at least.
Just two short ones, because I probably missed something. The first thing is, I don't want to focus on the tea guys anymore, because I'm more astonished about how you found empirical data on T-free communication, if I may say so. I mean, it's quite easy to find the Madrid guys, we have it, but where did you find the T-free communication?
So actually, there's a lot of research out there. It was originally targeted or meant for telecom operators to optimize the network. So they, like, starting from the late 70s, they looked at how do people communicate, yeah? How do the patterns look like, how much capacity do they need? And they did this in order to optimize their networks. Yeah? So to provide the required bandwidth, but not too much, because this would of course cost them money. Yeah? So there's a lot of research out there.
So we would assume that in the published data on huge networks, there are no terrorists, which is probably for the 80s true. And you know, these two or three. I mean, if you argue that it is relevant that in the date, so in the overall statistics that we had here, there is, which we mimic, that there are still some terrorists present, it must be a lot of terrorists. And then you would probably fall into the paranoia of, you know.
Essentially arguing that there are not many terrorists.
And it's actually randomized, right?
I hope so. But on the other hand, no, there's empirical evidence, right, for that. Otherwise, during this talk, we would have heard a lot of outside, right?
Now you're talking successful. But just to get another point made, you mentioned police work. Police officers are normally handling quite different persons, criminals. Terrorists are probably criminals too, but those might have less hierarchical communication structures because they are immersed in the public, probably.
I'm not talking about car theft by chance, basically, right? So we talk organized crimes. And there is also published data in social network analysis journals, actually, that the whole statistics basically holds the same because you end up with an organization. I mean, you will never ever have the single guy working independently. But I mean, whether it's a guy or organized in a drug cartel or in a terrorist organization, he has to order pizza, go to the dentist, and you know, book a flight to somewhere too. So that outside communication would necessarily be the same. Right? So it's only inside the community of whatever conspiring people that is different.
So exactly what does that F value correspond to, or how is it expressed?
What?
The factor F that you mentioned earlier,
okay.
What does it correspond to?
That is the rescaling factor of the distribution in inter-call time duration. So, you know, how frequent do people give a call, access the web, whatever?
And actually what's known from the literature is that those inter-call durations have an exponential distribution, usually, yeah? And this F essentially adjusts the parameters of those two distributions. So we said, in general, our T's communicate in a very similar way as ILEX, but only this parameter of this distribution actually changes. And this actually is some kind of worst case assumption, right? Because you have some very similar distributions, both for ILEX and T's, yeah? And still you are able, with some measures, to distinguish them. Yeah? So if you would use many, many different distributions, then the job of distinguishing them would actually get easier and not harder. And therefore, this was our choice to say, we assume the same distribution, but only change the parameters by a certain factor.
Another question from IRC. How much terrorist data do you have, and is it enough for your study to be accurate?
Well, you might say that there are other terrorist organizations, but again, we have three different terror networks. I do not know if there is any study present, say, for example, from the 70s terrorist groups. These are all Islamic terrorists. Yeah. So we averaged over all those models. So every plot here was always averaged over all those terrorist networks, which would probably also, you know, correlate to or correspond to the situation of a software manufacturer, because he wants probably to sell his measure, analysis, whatever device in different countries. So the one was from Spain again, and the other from the US. There might be other hidden ones that are much more clever, but what is the purpose of being completely hidden and not, you know, doing or implementing their plan? So that's what we know.
Just to give some numbers, the networks that we used vary between 15, 40, and about 100 individuals. Yeah, so we have some kind of variability already there. But of course, 100 in relation to 1 million is a very, very small number, of course. This is reality, right? I mean, you're not going to have T cells that are huge. Yeah? So you will always have to, needle in the haystack problem. Yeah.
And I would like to point out that this actually, the number or the size of the terrorist cell is the determining quantity that gives you really the upper bound of what you can do in these covariance measures, right? So we had these 3-point measures. You cannot go to 4 or 5 people in a chain because you have not enough data for these T cells. You have enough data, you know, from the whole population, but the statistics is too bad if you only have a T cell of, say, 50 or whatever. Then, you know, there's a rule of thumb by which you can estimate what is reasonable, what is a reasonable measure or expectation value. And that is the reason, as long as a terrorist cell is small enough, that holds. If you grow to a size of, say, 100,000 terrorists, then you can do much more sophisticated measures, but then it's a question whether these people have actually to resort to violence, because if they are so much, they might achieve, at least in a democracy, better results without violence anyway, so.
Okay, I saw even more questions out there, but we're over our time, so please come forward, talk to Kai and Stefan personally, and thank you.
Thanks.